From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Jim Hall, the musician many fellow musicians and critics consider the best guitarist in contemporary jazz. The college football season is climaxing with the bowl games. Coming up, sports writer and former college cornerback Rick Tander discusses corruption in college football and proposes an alternative to the college system. World music critic Milo Miles plays some international dance singles and speculates on their chances of becoming hits in America. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reads the updated Nancy Drew Mysteries designed to appeal to a new generation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Pentagon officials said today American troops had seized 10,000 weapons in three separate areas in their sweep through Panama City today. American military officials said U.S. forces are encountering the remnants of Noriega's armed civilian battalions. The Pentagon's latest casualty report from the invasion earlier this week lists 21 American soldiers dead, 221 wounded, two missing. 127 members of the Panamanian Defense Forces are reported killed. President Bush sent a message to Congress today telling lawmakers he cannot predict how long U.S. forces will remain in Panama. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
U.S. officials had hoped that most of the 11,000 or so troops sent to Panama this week would be on their way back to the States in a few days. But the president told members of Congress today it is not possible at this time to predict the precise scope and duration of the military operations or how long the temporary increases of U.S. forces in Panama will be required. In a later speech, the president reiterated the open-ended nature of the Panama invasion.
We will continue to do what is necessary to help the people of Panama achieve the democratic society that they voted for and that they so rightfully deserve.
Aides say the president is likely to visit with some of the soldiers wounded in Panama when he travels to Texas next week. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
The Organization of American States, which rarely rebukes the U.S., has voiced overwhelming opposition to the American invasion of Panama. A resolution expressing deep regret over the invasion was approved early this morning, 20-1, with the United States casting the only vote against. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
In addition to regretting the U.S. invasion, the resolution called for a ceasefire and the withdrawal of the newly arrived American forces. It also rejected the U.S. claim that the invasion was justified under Article 21 of the OAS Charter. The final resolution was considerably milder than an earlier draft proposed by Nicaragua, which condemned the invasion rather than simply regretting it. Still, the U.S. State Department was not pleased. Spokesman Richard Boucher.
We're outraged. The OAS missed an historic opportunity to get beyond its traditional narrow concern with non-intervention.
Luigi Einaudi, the U.S. ambassador to the OAS, said last night, by improperly invoking the legitimate principle of non-intervention in this case, the OAS will find itself cast on the side of dictators and tyrants. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
U.S. officials said today a Colombian sought by the United States on drug charges has been captured in a town 450 miles north of Bogota. Rafael Julio Fernandez was arrested Tuesday and brought to Bogota. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 20 points to close the day at 2011.23. Advances led declines 2-1. This is NPR News. Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu was forced from power today. Ceausescu led Romania for 24 years. He is reported to have fled the country with his wife Elena. According to television reports, a battle for control of strategic points in Bucharest erupted tonight between soldiers who joined the uprising and forces loyal to Ceausescu. Hundreds of thousands of Romanians are still in Bucharest Republic Square. Hours after the mass demonstration began to celebrate the flight of Ceausescu, Pierre Vicari reports that fighting is continuing in the streets of the capital.
The former Romanian royal palace is in flames, and pitched battles are continuing on the streets of Bucharest. Secret police units loyal to deposed dictator Nicolae Ceausescu have been staging a desperate counteroffensive against the army. The sound of automatic weapons has filled the night sky for hours, and the Yugoslav news agency Tanjug reports that over 100 people have died. The fate of Ceausescu and his wife is uncertain, although Romanian television announced that both had left the country. Their son, Nicu, was arrested in Transylvania and later appeared in the Bucharest television studio during a live broadcast that's been going non-stop since the end of the dictatorship. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb, Yugoslavia.
A Maryland state judge is in stable condition today after a letter bomb exploded in his apartment in Hagerstown. Judge John Quarterman is in serious condition. He was injured when a pipe bomb detonated in his hands. The bomb was inside an 8-by-10-inch package delivered by mail to the judge's home. Police said the bomb was similar to those used in a series of recent bomb attacks in the South. The Justice Department said today four threatening letters delivered this week bore physical evidence linking them with the bomb that killed a circuit court judge and a Georgia civil rights lawyer earlier this week. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jim Hall is the favorite guitarist of many jazz musicians and listeners. Since the 1960s, he's been a regular winner of the Downbeat Critics Poll. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot describes Hall as having a grace and inventiveness and lyricism that make him preeminent among contemporary jazz guitarists and put him within touching distance of the two grandmasters, Charlie Christian and Django Reinhardt. Hall started recording in the 1950s. In the early part of his career, he played with groups led by Jimmy Giuffre, Chico Hamilton, Ben Webster, and Sonny Rollins. Hall records now for Concord Jazz and has a new album called All Across the City. Over the years, Hall has made many duet recordings. This is from a recent session with bassist Ron Carter. The song is Alone Together. Since we're coming up to Christmas, why don't we start off with the gift you got when you were 10 years old for Christmas, which was your first guitar.
It's my first guitar, right. Yeah, my mom bought that for me in Cleveland, Ohio, and we sort of paid it off $1.25 or something a week to this music store in Cleveland, and I took lessons. I think the lessons were 75 cents, and the rest went toward the guitar. So it took about a year to actually pay it off.
Had you hinted for the guitar? Did you know you wanted one?
I had this Uncle Ed who was sort of like Willie Nelson in Ohio. He wasn't that famous, but he played the guitar and he sang country songs and he always had nice looking ladies around him. So I thought that looks like a good way to go.
So many musicians seem to have chosen their instrument or decided to play music because it would help you
nice
make it with
ladies,
the ladies.
Yeah. He also drank a lot and I decided not to go that way.
Mm-hmm. So. Did you have any idea what you wanted to play?
I don't believe I did until I heard Charlie Christian, which was about 3 years later. I heard him on Benny Goodman Records, and then I knew that whatever he was doing was what I wanted to do. I didn't really know. It just seemed like a nice idea to hold a guitar and play it. So,
is it fair to say that Charlie Christian has remained your primary influence over the years?
I think so, yeah. I hadn't really thought about it quite that way, but when I hear him now, on those records that I heard when I was 13, he sounds better than he did when I was 13. And I would still, I think if I could play one solo that sounds to me as complete and perfect as the way Charlie played, I would feel great. So, yes, I think he's still the Holy Grail or something that I'm looking for.
What were the early bands like that you played in?
Terrible. I played polkas and mazurkas and all kinds of stuff and didn't really know any better. And I think it was good that I didn't, because I got all that groundwork out of the way before my judgment had formed. We had a, in junior high school, there was a quartet, which was accordion, clarinet, drums, and guitar. So you can almost hear it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the good thing about that was that the clarinet player...
A strange grouping of instruments.
Kind of standard, yeah. No, nobody owned a bass.
Uh-huh.
Accordion was very big in Ohio. And we played all kinds of stuff, probably very badly. But the clarinet player loved Benny Goodman, and so it was through him that I heard Charlie Christian. And then shortly after that, I started playing in better groups. I got socially and musically involved with older guys, like in their 20s, who got me listening to Lester Young and Coleman Hawkins and Ben Webster and Art Tatum. Art Tatum was a big influence, musical influence. So by the time I was, say, 15 or 16, I was pretty well gone down the jazz road there.
Well, in one interview, you said that you felt you were leading a double life when you were in high school, because on the one hand, you were the president of your class and making speeches about citizenship.
Right.
But on the other hand, you were spending your evenings playing in a saloon.
In saloons, right.
Yeah, with guys much older than you were. Well, did you feel any guilt about spending your nights playing in saloons?
yes, I did. I'm still getting over it. 100 years of analysis later. Oh, sure, the Midwestern kind of... religious upbringing and the conflict that involved. It was probably one of the reasons I stayed in music was because it was considered slightly sinful to be playing jazz in a saloon. So, yeah, there was some kind of conflict, but I loved it at that time. And I'm still trying to straighten it out.
Were you from a religious upbringing?
Kind of. Protestant Baptist. And I don't want to get into the whole thing, but some parts of the family were a little even more extreme than the Baptists, and there was a lot of dichotomy there between the music that I loved and the way of life that was supposed to be correct.
So did you get any pressure?
Is that carefully enough?
Yeah, right. Well, did you get pressure from your family to get out of that life?
Yeah, occasionally I did, but then. Gradually, I went straight for 5 years. I went to an actual music school, a conservatory, and that seemed to satisfy some of that straight and narrow stuff. Also turned me into a much better musician. It was one of the best things I've ever done. So after I graduated from high school, I went through the Cleveland Institute of Music for about 5 years. And that was terrific. And then I continued my life of sin right after that, up to the present.
Well, you actually dropped out before getting your master's degree.
I did, yeah.
And decided to go to the West Coast. Mm-hmm. Was that a big risk for you, and were you a risk taker?
I think what happened was that I finally panicked at the idea of being in school forever. I'd been there for 5 years, and a lot of the people that I knew were going to school in order to stay on in school and teach. And I think somewhere in the back of my mind, I'd always wondered if I could be a professional guitar player, because I was doing that all the time anyway, weekends and during the summer. So in a sense, it was a risk in that the only thing I had in Los Angeles was I had this aunt who said I could sleep on her couch if I came out there. And I had one friend with whom I'd studied arranging, who was pretty successful in Los Angeles. So... In that sense, it was a risk, but another sense, it felt great. A friend of mine and me drove a car out. You could deliver cars then and just pay the gas money. So we drove this lavender Cadillac to Los Angeles, and I started practicing as soon as we took off from Cleveland. I sat in the back seat and practiced, and I practiced for about the next 2 years. So it was a lot of fun, actually, more than a chance.
Guitarist Jim Hall is my guest, and let me play the first album that you recorded under your own name, mm-hmm. you know, with your group, and mm-hmm. then we'll talk about the events leading up to it. And this is from an album that was first released in 1957 that's since been reissued on compact disc. The album's called Jazz Guitar, And Jim Hall's trio in this features Carl Perkins at the piano and Red Mitchell on bass. Let's hear Tangerine. Guitarist Jim Hall from his first album called Jazz Guitar. How old were you when you made that record?
Let's see, 26, I guess. 25, 26, 26, I think.
What were you working on?
I thought you were
going to
say, what was I
time?
Wearing?
No.
What was I working?
No, and you're playing. You know, what were you really concerned with
I was just thinking about that as the record was playing. I think I probably loved Zoot Sims and Lester Young about then. And I can kind of hear that in my playing. I was around Zoot Sims a lot for a period of years, and I loved his rhythmic sense, his sense of time, and I loved Lester's melodic sense. So it sounds like kind of a combination of the two of them and a little bit of Charlie Christian. The notes were a little shorter than the way I play now. Sounded pretty good, actually. I enjoyed hearing that.
I think it sounds real good. What's responsible for the change, you know, in the lengthening of the notes?
I'm not sure, just different influences, finding what things that I do better in music, and selfishly putting myself in surroundings where I can do my best. And I think I tend more toward ballads, and I'm really not sure what it's just a matter of, I hope, of some kind of growth, and I think my hearing has changed over the years.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
And my guest is one of today's top jazz guitarists, Jim Hall, and he has a new album that's just been released on Concord Records, and it's called All Across the City. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Guitarist Jim Hall is my guest. Over the years, you've played with many different musicians, including Jimmy Giuffre, who you mentioned, Ben Webster, Sonny Rollins, Lee Konitz, Bill Evans. Some of the musicians you've played with have been black. Some of them have been white. You've played in groups of, I think, all different racial configurations. Mm-hmm. And there's been times when the group has been predominantly white with a black musician, and there's times where the group's been predominantly black and you've been the white musician. Mm-hmm. What are some of the absurdities you've run into in various configurations with how, like, the black player or the white player was treated?
Often, when I was working with Sonny Rollins, I was, hate to even get into racial things, but nevertheless, it's a fact that I was the white guy in the group, and often we'd be checking into a hotel, and the people at the hotel would assume I was the manager, whereas in reality I was the most unmanageable one in the group. And then I remember driving cross country with Chico Hamilton, and this was in the 50s, and Chico wouldn't even get out of the car going through the South and the West, and I'd have to go in for you know, for food and bring it out to him. And he was the leader of the group. That was, I would say, absurd in every sense of the word. Mostly the experiences were terrific. I wouldn't trade any of that. Just, you know, the peripheral business was reflected the what was happening in the country, and still is, I think.
After playing for years and, you know, after being on the road for years in the mid-1960s, you decided to come off the mm-hmm. road for a while, and you got a job in New York working in the band of the Merv Griffin Show.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to go off the road?
I felt I'd had enough of it for a while. I was interested in getting married, and I'm not quite sure. I think I was tired. I'd been on the road almost constantly for about 10 years. And the Griffin Show job was available, so I took it.
What kinds of music were you called on to play?
Garbage. the same people. I felt like I was, what did Yogi Berra say? Deja vu all over again. I had played for these nuts when I was a kid. You know, you'd play a wedding and the bride would have a cousin or something, and he'd come up and sing, and it was always bad, and they'd get lost. So now these guys are stars, and you're, so I did this when I was 14. That's the way it felt to me. And then occasionally, well, I on the other hand, I got to play with Count Basie on that show. We had a big band for a while when I went to CBS, and I had never played with Basie, and I also got to play with Duke Ellington. You know, by default, we were there, we were the band. But generally, we would play while the world was watching TV commercials. We'd be playing some of our stuff. And it was a good band. Musically, it was terrific. Bob Brookmeyer was in the band. Richie Kamuka, marvelous tenor player. Jake Hanna was the drummer. For a while, we had Kai Winding. Benny Powell was another trombone player. Great, great musicians. But I don't even particularly want to dwell on it. It was just a bad, not something that I would, it's not what I started out to do, and I managed to get out of it.
Hmm. Well, I want to play something that you recorded in the mid-1970s. This is from an album called Concerto. And I'm going to play the alternate take of your recording of The Answer Is Yes, which is a song that was written by your wife, Jane mm-hmm. Hall. And playing the alternate take here because it features a lot more of you.
And yeah.
It's issued on the CD version of the album. You want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Yeah, I'm nervous. I never heard this.
You didn't?
Take. Oh. It's a tough tune. My wife did write it, and I say that because it has the bridge on it is difficult. And I remember that Chet Baker had a tough time getting through the bridge. Because he didn't read chord changes. He played entirely by ear. He's a marvelous player. I'm curious to hear it.
Well, let's give it a listen.
Yeah. Thank you.
An excerpt of The Answer is Yes, featuring my guest, guitarist Jim Hall, from his reissued album, Concierto. Well, I liked it. What'd you think?
It was kind of interesting. Roland Hanna wasn't even on that take, it sounds like, and neither was Chet. So maybe that's why we did another one. I guess that was just a trio version. I think I have a CD of that, but I haven't heard it yet. I sort of liked the way I was thrashing through the chord changes there. Worked out all right.
You've never been one of these, like, flashy speed guitarists.
No. I never could. Actually, I often wish that I could do that and then just not, because I chose not to. But the guitar's been difficult for me to play physically. It gets better occasionally. Like, for instance, I was talking with Don Lukoff on the way up here. I had to play solos in Brazil a couple of years ago, and that really frightened me. So I practiced every morning. I'd wake up in a sweat about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd practice till about 9, then go back to sleep. And I actually did get better. My technique got better. I got faster. I also got through the solo concerts. But I've never really had that particular kind of speed facility. I think I have other kinds of techniques that I use on the guitar, but speed has never been one of them. So that's why I play slower tempos and ballads.
Certain people have this almost stereotyped view of the jazz musician as hipster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's an image that physically you don't fit into. Do you know what I mean?
The
hipster image. Did people ever say to you, you don't look like a jazz musician?
Mm-hmm. Yes, or a number of other things, too. Yeah, sure. That's why I said people thought I was the band manager on the road.
Right. So how do you react to that?
I enjoy that. I get a kick out of it. If you can play, then it makes it even more fun. You don't look like an athlete, but actually you're Babe Ruth or something. That's pretty good.
Right. Well, Jim Hall, I wish you a happy holidays.
Thanks
and
very
a happy
much,
New
Terry.
Year, and thanks a lot for talking with
Thank
us.
Thank you. It was really fun. Thanks.
Jim Hall's new album, All Across the City, is on Concord Jazz. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a holiday concert with singer Susanna McCorkle. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Rick Dellinger has seen college football from both sides, as a cornerback for Northwestern University and as a staff writer for Sports Illustrated. His new book, The 100-Yard Lie, is a scathing indictment of the college football system. Coming up, Dellinger talks about the corruption he's witnessed and about some possible solutions. Also, world music commentator Milo Miles plays some international dance singles that have made it big abroad. He wonders if they'll be hits in the U.S. And Maureen Carrigan ponders some of the lessons learned from her old role model, Nancy Drew, and laments the updated version of the mystery series she's found on bookstore shelves. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Panama City, gunfire was heard in the streets near the National Assembly today, while in an hour-long firefight with U.S. troops, Forces loyal to General Noriega attacked U.S. military headquarters. The search for the general continued on the third day of the U.S. invasion. The Pentagon said today that it may take from 5 to 10 days for U.S. forces to take complete control of Panama City. At the same time, President Bush said that he was determined to keep troops deployed to do what is necessary to establish democracy in the country. Military officials raised the possibility of sending more American troops to Panama in addition to the 24,000 troops already there. A state circuit court judge in Hagerstown, Maryland, has been injured by a bomb and is now reported in stable condition. Early reports indicate the bomb was taken to the judge's apartment by a delivery man just before it exploded. There is no indication whether this attack is similar to a recent string of bombings of judges and civil rights workers in the southeastern United States. But officials believe that other bombs are working their way through the mails. More from NPR's Jim Angle.
A series of letters addressed to those who have already received bombs and some who have not have led investigators to issue another warning to judges and those in the civil rights community. Tom Moore is the spokesman for the FBI office in Birmingham, Alabama.
We are really trying to urge everybody to remain alert for the possibility that there are more explosive devices in the packages, as we've shown earlier, still in the mail stream, based on the information that our investigators have uncovered.
Officials in Washington said there is hard evidence linking the letters to the bombs. The letters are written under the name Americans for a Competent Federal Judiciary. Several were received this week, some by those who had already been sent bombs. Others who received the letters have not received bombs, but investigators fear they will. One official said some of the letters were addressed with the words, "to the late," followed by the individual's name. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
The Senate Ethics Committee will go ahead with a preliminary inquiry into the activities of six senators, Mara Liasson reports.
The Senate Ethics Committee has formally opened a preliminary inquiry into the Keating Five and into the activities of Alphonse D'Amato, who was accused of influence peddling. The Keating Five are Democrats Dennis DeConcini, Alan Cranston, John Glenn, Don Regal, and Republican John McCain. They all received large campaign contributions from Charles Keating, the owner of the failed Lincoln Savings and Loan Association. It's estimated that it will cost the taxpayers $2 billion to bail Lincoln out. The five are accused of interfering with federal regulators on Keating's behalf. D'Amato is charged with using his influence to steer housing funds to his campaign contributors in New York. The purpose of a preliminary inquiry is to determine whether there is sufficient reason to believe that the senators violated ethics rules.
This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. All over the world, top 40 stations and their equivalents are on the lookout for songs with that catchy hook that will grab listeners. World music commentator Milo Miles notes that dance singles with international musicians sometimes have a good shot at big radio play. But he says it's hard to predict how well these records will go over. This one will soon be released in the U.S.
If they have any guts at all, record producers and radio programmers can prove that it's much easier to make audiences listen to a strange single than a whole strange album. A single goes by quick. It's an ephemeral thrill, one no less deep for that. For continental Europe, the left-field wonder single of the past year is Lambada by the producer-assembled group Kaoma. Kaoma features former members of the band Touré Kunda from Senegal, as well as singers and dancers from Brazil. Lambada has a slinky pulse with an Afro-Latin feel and highlights the old bandonian accordion, most familiar from tangos. The thirst for lambada is so intense in France, West Germany, Holland, and Spain that many rip-off versions exist. Here's an especially thick and cheesy one. Enough of that. If you heard the moans and groans in the background, you got a clue that part of Lambada's popularity comes from its notorious video, the kind that's invariably described as torrid or steamy. Will Lambada catch on in the U.S. now that Epic has released the single here? Initially, I would have said, no way. I mean, top 40 with a bandonian? But after listening to it some more, I gotta say, it's a catchy little sucker. You hear it a few times, you want to hear it a few more. This is some of the extended mix of the original Keoma Lambada. You would expect compulsive grab baggers like the English group called The Art of Noise to eventually snatch up a world music sound and make a hit with it. I'm not a big Art of Noise fan. Their cynical dance beats have been too predictable for years, and their campy remakes of songs like Prince's Kiss with Tom Jones have got to stop. Now, however, they have released a single, Yebo, featuring South Africa's Malathini and the three Mahotela Queens on vocals. This is the stripped-down version of Yebo. You see why you never say Malathini, but always Malathini. In the past couple of years, there have been dozens of attempts to mix ethnic world beats with hip-hop and acid house disco. Most of the results turn out very clunky. By keeping the touch light and the bass rhythms just rootsy enough, Art of Noise have delivered a pretty fine world beat fusion single in Yebo. It's not a great one, but it beats the competition right now. By the way, Yebo is about Zulu warriors praising young tribal dancers. Finally, our Art of Noise using Malathini and the Mahotola Queens as an exotic gimmick, and one that Paul Simon thought of first, even? Well, kind of. But almost nobody has turned down having a hit single because it featured a gimmick. Who knows? You may be hearing Yebo all over the radio in early 1990.
Milo Miles writes about music for the Village Voice in the New York Times.
Yes, well, listen to this, I'm a suit. Nitin Elsentis. Via Seed, Via Pig, Chapulani, Chapulani.
This is Fresh Air. It's College Bowl time. There's big money in college football, but the players don't get paid. The idea of amateur athletics may sound idealistic, but Rick Tellender thinks that amateurism in college football is an illusion that's led to exploitation, corruption, and greed in the game. Tellender has covered college sports for Sports Illustrated. He's also had firsthand experience, having played football for Northwestern. Tellender has a new book about corruption in college football called The 100-Yard Lie. Nevertheless, I asked him if he's looking forward to the bowl games.
It isn't really hard for me to have a lot of enthusiasm because the games, the contests themselves, are still spectacular. They're tremendous TV fodder. A football field is a great TV studio, and our instant replay and the way that the TV cameramen and the producers capture the events is just is great. But it's hard for me also knowing the underlying hypocrisies of big-time college football. That part of it is hard also.
Well, you find the whole notion of amateurism in college football absurd, and you think that the universities are exploiting the athletes because the colleges make money and the athletes are supposed to not accept money for the sport. Why do you think amateurism is absurd?
Well, amateurism is absurd not just as it applies to big-time college football or basketball, but it's absurd as a notion. All you have to do is go back and examine its historic roots. It began in Victorian England as a way to keep the classes, the lower classes, from mingling with the upper classes. Victorian England claimed that they were lifting this notion from the ancient Greeks, from the ancient Olympic ideal. Well, I went back and talked with some Greek scholars and those who have written about the ancient Olympics. And there never was any such concept of amateurism. In fact, the ancient Greeks would have laughed at the notion of amateurism. If you won an Olympic event back in, say, 400 BC, you were set up with so much riches and so many things of great value that you were set for life. And that's the way they felt anyone who was good at anything should be rewarded. There's nothing evil about money. What is evil is exploitation and hypocrisy.
Just to give us an example of how much money is involved in college football, what are the revenues from the bowl games that are coming up?
Well, the bowl game revenue continues to climb. A few years ago, it was $500,000, then $1 million, then $2 million, then three, then four. We're up to $5 million, over $5 million, almost $6 million for the Rose Bowl, and a little bit less for the Orange Bowl, the Cotton Bowl, the Sugar Bowl, and games like that. The school doesn't keep that money. The athletic department keeps it, and they will then use that for whatever purposes they may feel are needed to keep their program going. But that kind of money, say you're a wide receiver, say you're 19 years old, a sophomore, you drop a pass in the last game of the season, which prevents you then from going to the Rose Bowl or prevents you from going to, say, the Orange Bowl, you know that by dropping that pass, you have cost your athletic department millions of dollars. What kind of pressure is that to put on a kid who supposedly is participating in an extracurricular activity? I think it's crazy. And beyond the bowl revenue, what about the money now that the big TV networks have thrown at college sports? CBS recently signed the NCAA Final 64-team basketball tournament for $1 billion for 7 years. Suppose there are 8 or 9 players on a basketball team that is going, which typically would be how many you would use, and they play 6 games and make it to the final, the championship, and they win the championship. They will have brought in over $15 million to their athletic department, and they will have received nothing for it. And in fact, quite often they will have been torn away from school, from studies, from final exams. It's really cockeyed. I bring up one other example. 15-year-old Monica Seles, the tennis player, she's a pro. It doesn't seem to bother anybody. She has made hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. That doesn't bother anyone. There's now a 13-year-old female tennis player getting ready to join the women's tennis tour. That doesn't bother anybody either, but somehow it bothers us when 21, 22-year-old football players even think about making money.
When you were a college player, what effects did it have on you to know that you not only weren't going to get paid for the sport, but according to NCAA guidelines, you couldn't have a job during the school year?
Well, again, it makes you think, do these people know who we are? Do they really care about us, or are they just trying to promote a system that benefits them? You know, I would submit now that there really isn't time during the season or the school year for a football player to have a part-time job because it's really a full-time job in and of itself. it's very easy to put in 40 or 50, 60 hours a week on football during the season. And then there's post season training and then spring practice. And then, of course, all summer long, you better be staying in shape, lifting weights and running and just generally working on the skills that are needed so that you can participate in the fall. But when I was in school, I remember being hungry. I was one of these skinny defensive backs who wanted food all the time. It seemed like I could eat about 8,000 calories a day. In fact, I know I could, and gain maybe a quarter of a pound. And then I'd play a game and lose 3 or 4 pounds. So I took a part-time job as a pizza delivery boy so that I could eat pizza. That was one of the deals. You got 50 cents for each pizza that you delivered, and plus you could eat all the pizza and hamburgers and make yourself milkshakes while you're waiting around for the next order to come in. That was in direct violation of NCAA rules. Didn't matter to me at all because I knew then, as at age 18 and 19, that they were frauds. And I think it's still something that bothers me to see adults using kids. And that's why at one point in my book, I say this is akin to child abuse, and people have jumped all over me for that. I stand by it completely. It is very offensive to me when adults do things to kids, and even if these are big, strapping young men, they're still kids in that they are pawns to authority, and that just bothers me.
What are some of the ways that players today get around the rules that prevent them from earning money for playing football and from having jobs during the school year?
Well, they find all sorts of ways of giving you money. You can have fraudulent jobs in the summertime. Players also will get free cars that will be hidden behind ownership by one of their parents or an uncle or an aunt. There's all sorts of ways to get money, but the trouble is you have to do it in a fraudulent manner. It means that you have already acquiesced and far from being an ethical, upstanding person and learning the things that I think our institutions of higher education should be teaching you, you've already given up and said, yeah, I'm a con, the system is corrupt, I'm going to be corrupt, that's the only way I can possibly compete with it. So by the time these guys get to the NFL, you've got some full-blown mercenaries and greedy, money-grubbing players who've been taught this through the college system.
Well, you think that it's not only the hypocritical approach to amateurism that's creating mercenaries and corrupt values, but you think the coaches have something to do with it, too, and the values that they bring to their training.
Yes, I do. And I think that coaches are, in the classic sense, caught between a rock and a hard place. If they say that they want to teach these athletes to become better men, to learn how to act properly in the real world, to educate them with values that are ones that can carry them through life to make them better people, that simply isn't in keeping with what they really have to do, what their real job description is. And you see it again and again. Their job description is win. It doesn't matter how you do it. It doesn't matter who you do it with, but you'd better win. Don Morton was just fired at Wisconsin in the third year of a five-year contract. Not because he had done anything corrupt or there was any problem with any of his players. He seemed to have run a very clean program. But because he wasn't winning. It happened. I can't even count all the teams where that happens. And yet a coach that is a bad guy and teaches sort of antisocial behavior or tolerates it and yet wins, his contract will be renewed again and again.
You end your new book with some suggestions for change. And your major suggestion is to start a new league, an age group league, that would be college age players, but they wouldn't be in college.
Right. You could be in college. You could, if you found that you had the time and the inclination, you could go to class the way a normal student would. So what I'm submitting we do is have a league that would be virtually identical to what we have right now. You wouldn't know the difference. There would be no need for realignment. There would be no need for changing the names of the teams, the colors of the teams, or anything. You would still have the Illinois Fighting Illini, the Oklahoma Sooners, the USC Trojans, University of Florida Gators, and they would wear the same colors, play in the same stadiums, but they would be players age 18 to 22 in this age group league. They would participate in the revenue that they bring in. They would receive a year of redeemable scholarship for every year that they play in this league while they're housed on this campus, and they can use that scholarship any time during their lives. So they could come back at age 50 or 60 or 70 or 23 and be a real full-time student and get that degree or that education that they now will have the time and the inclination to get.
You've been covering college football for Sports Illustrated. How much longer are you going to cover the game, given that you're very cynical about the way it's being run now?
Well, I don't want to cover college football at all. In fact, I took myself off the beat. I talked with the editors in New York. We had a meeting. They were very understanding of my problems, and I now am writing about the NBA and about the NFL. At least, you know, it's up front. Play for pay. I'm writing profiles of athletes, but I don't want to write about college football itself or college basketball, really, because I just feel that this is my form of protest so that we can do something that is equitable.
You're very cynical right now about college football. Are you going to watch the bowl games anyways?
I'll watch a couple of them. I have to keep my eye on it as sort of the conscience of the sport.
Okay. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Okay, well, thank you, Terry.
Rick Tellender's new book, The 100-Yard Lie, is published by Simon & Schuster. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. In Romania, reports of fighting in the streets between the military and forces loyal to the just-deposed leader Nicolae Ceaușescu. In Panama, reports of fighting in the streets between the American military and forces loyal to the just-deposed leader Manuel Noriega. Also, we'll have a cold weather conversation with a man in Havre, Montana, where last night it went down to 43 degrees below zero, and that is the temperature not including the wind chill. And on quite a bit of a lighter note, we'll meet the two actors who play 21 roles altogether in the new play, Tuna Christmas.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Like thousands of pre-adolescent girls, critic Maureen Carrigan found her first role model in girl detective Nancy Drew, heroine of the popular mystery series. Carrigan says that future generations may not have the same opportunity.
A few years ago, I was riding with a friend on the Jersey Turnpike when suddenly she slammed on the brakes to avoid hitting a car drifting into our lane. Afterwards, I realized that I had relaxed my body to prepare for a collision because an image of Nancy Drew had flashed into my mind. Her convertible was about to ram some thug's jalopy, and Nancy, correctly, relaxed her body just before the moment of impact. I know now that in times of crisis, I'll be able to recall the other life-saving tips Nancy taught me. Everything from how to signal SOS to how to hold my hands when being tied up so I can slip the knots and escape. I read my first Nancy Drew when I was 8. The Ghost of Blackwood Hall was in my Christmas stocking. That magic reading initiated me into a network of girl detectives who spoke in a Baroque code. Nancy was always identified as a Titian-haired sleuth, and she drove convertibles, or roadsters. Her boyfriend, Ned Nickerson, was her beau, and she often used the highbrow contraction, shant. These weren't exactly everyday words in Queens, so my family thought I'd become odd. But like most other Nancy fans, I later aced the vocabulary section of the SATs. The language of the series created an aristocratic worldview that fascinated simple girls like me. Nancy was always saving wealthy clients from swarthy, unkempt goons named Stumpy or Mr. Wart. The books also fed our pre-adolescent Electra complexes. Nancy's father, Carson Drew, was handsome, distinguished, and widowed. The Drew's matronly housekeeper, Hannah Grun, was no threat to the father-daughter bond. In a 1975 book called The Girl Sleuth, Bobby Ann Mason speculates on the sexual subtext of the Nancy Drew mysteries. She jokes that because Nancy is always delving into secret compartments, the series celebrates a girl's discovery of masturbation. Eek! Nancy would rather die first! I treasure Nancy Drew as the first autonomous female I met in fiction, so I was thrilled when a friend told me her daughter Eileen had started reading the books. I went to buy some for her and discovered that publishers had done what all the thugs in River Heights couldn't. They rubbed out Nancy. She's now a girl of the 80s. She goes to rock concerts and Fort Lauderdale for spring break. Hannah Groon serves pizza and curry instead of those wasp tea sandwiches. And Ned even kisses Nancy. Only her Titian hair has survived the vocabulary purge, though Nancy's self-reliance and class prejudice have remained intact. Why do publishers update certain books? Are the social myths of Heidi any more universal? Granted, Nancy Drew is a commercial series, but Little Women was also part of a girl's series, and we wouldn't dream of tampering with it. The new books are probably okay, but I'm a purist about pop culture, so this Christmas I'm giving Eileen my old copy of The Password to Larkspur Lane. That's the one where Nancy teaches us how to train homing pigeons, trace our family coat of arms, outwit jewel thieves, and fend off a moonstruck Ned Nickerson. It's information every girl still needs to know.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and music reviews. Our interviews are produced by Amy Salat and Phyllis Myers. Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock are our production assistants. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you enjoy the holidays.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
As the decade draws to a close, we're going into the Fresh Air archives to bring you interviews and performances from the 80s that we think you'll enjoy. We get things started with a concert with singer Susanna McCorkle and an interview with singer Bobby McFerrin. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.